The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition this week. Final EDU show of 2022. It's going to feel a little different, though. It's going to feel like a Q&A show, because the twist we're going to put on this final EDU show of 2022 is that we're going to answer questions that have all come in the month of December. So kind of like kind of an extension of our theme of always answering, the hot new question of the week. We're going to do the hot new questions of this month as much as we can get caught up on that. That'll be our little holiday gift to those who have sent in questions more recently. So Jim's with me here in the
studio. Of course, now you upset everybody who sent in questions prior to that. They're going to think, what is my Christmas gift?
What about the ones from November, right?
But I just thought, folks, this is on my shoulders, not Chris's. But I just thought it would be something different. Remember I said we're going to do... Mm-hmm. Q&A style EDU shows for the entire month of December. We had Chris on. No, excuse me. Chris is always on. We had Greg on and Bob on. And then we did a few little unique things. And this is going to be it. Game show, because we don't have a guest on.
That's pronounced huh?
Huh? But we'll bring that back in 2023 as well, folks. I promise. We'll start to play that next time we have a guest. We're going to have to get someone. Let's get Pete on, and then we'll hit him with that. He'll probably never come on again.
You think it's hard getting him on now?
Yeah. Make him play a round of, huh? And he'll just get up and walk out, I'm sure. Yeah.
So for people who listen to all our shows, we'll have one more for 2022 that'll release on New Year's Eve. On December 31st, we'll be recording that one in a few days here.
A typical Q&A show for that.
Just another Q&A. So it'll be a week of Q's and A's.
Q's and A's. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. All righty. But that should be it. I think this is playing after Christmas. So I hope everybody listening had a wonderful holiday and Christmas if you celebrate Christmas or whatever holiday you celebrate. If you don't celebrate Christmas, there's a few of them around this time of year. So hopefully you had a nice time with your family and loved ones. And this will also come out before New Year's, right? So we can wish everybody a Happy New Year's too.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
At least those who celebrate New Year's.
I think everybody celebrates New Year. I mean, everyone's going to be impacted. If you aren't impacted by the new year, you're dead. So I would much prefer to be impacted by the new year than to be dead.
Yeah, but some people recognize the new year or not. It's not January 1st like we do.
Who the hell recognizes it on another day than January 1st?
There's other countries around the world that use a different calendar.
Like who? Name one.
China.
China uses a... Oh, that's right. They do like year of the cat, year of the dog, year of the chicken.
And the Chinese New Year is not January 1st on our calendar.
Oh.
I mean, you want to... There's one example, but maybe there's others. I don't know.
Okay. Well, for all our Chinese listeners, I'm sorry if I offended you. But for everyone else, I hope you enjoy a happy new year. How's that?
Perfect.
All right. Okay, let's jump into this. We're going to lead with a Social Security question. This is a December email, and it begins, "Hello, Jim, Chris, and team." He could have saved some typing just by putting "Hello, Chris," because Jim and team do not help with Social Security. Chris does. He said, "I have been a loyal listener for the last 3 years and have appreciated all the great retirement knowledge that you share, especially Jim. I think he is brilliant."
Okay, no, he did not say that. There's no way. No one talks like that. We've already been over this. You got to find a different way to slip those in.
What do you mean no one says...
Patting yourself on the back. Has anyone said he is brilliant who wasn't trying to get to the top of the list or something?
Maybe this man was just being kind. Did you ever think of that? It is the holiday season, Ebenezer.
Maybe. Okay, I guess he could have said that, but I suspect no.
You saying I ad-libbed?
I don't know. You can send me the email. I'll check it.
No. No, we don't need to do that. "I retired in 2021 at age 63 and plan to delay Social Security until age 70 if all goes well. Mm-hmm. My question is, how does Social Security capture your post-age 62 work credits? Since when you turn 62, they calculate your benefit based on your work history up to age 62. For some people, their highest income can be just before they retire." Mm-hmm. Then he has a related question. "My related question, does the Social Security website estimator capture the post-age 62 work credits when calculating the projected future benefits?" Do you want to answer that?
Yeah. So not everyone realizes that even after you get to Social Security claiming age, which for standard retirement benefits is going to be as early as age 62, that work after that point can actually affect your benefit. Not everyone. Kind of depends on your previous work history. And even if they're fairly large earnings after you reach 62, many people don't really notice much because they already have a nice set of 35 indexed earnings years that they're the Social Security Administration is using to determine their benefits. So you may not notice it, but if you're like he mentioned that, you know, your heavier earning years are at the end and they're substantially higher than maybe earlier in your work life, that as you create those new entries in your earnings record, he's essentially asking, how are they going to factor those in, or do they? And they do. Every single year that you work, whether you're Social Security claiming age or not, whether you're claiming Social Security or not, Social Security Administration gets that information from the IRS through all the reporting that is done there, that to get your earnings. And actually the earnings, I'm not sure, runs through IRS. It comes through the payroll withholding activities that you're experiencing with your employer. And the earnings are reported ultimately to Social Security. And as they get that information, they take a look at your earnings record and plop that new earnings, say if you're at 62, 63, 64, 65, 85, if you're still working at that age. And if that entry then becomes one of your top 35 years, and remember, it isn't at face value. All those earlier earnings years up to the age of 60, they have indexed for inflation. So they've adjusted them so that your earnings in your 20s, 30s, and 40s are more kind of on equal footing to those in your late 50s and early 60s, or late 50s up to 60 should be a more accurate way of saying that. But if you really have high earnings focused or concentrated at the end of your career, you may very well kick out an earlier lower earnings entry. And now this new entry is considered in your top 35. Now, remember, it's just a single year that's being replaced. Those who notice the biggest difference when they recalculate their benefit, which Social Security automatically does it. You don't have to ask them to do it. They're going to look at your earnings every single year that gets reported to them. And whether you're claiming or not, even if you have earnings in your 60s and 70s, they're going to keep track of those and look at those. And if that entry into your earnings record increases the benefit calculation, you'll get credit for it. Not only that, they're going to give you that benefit retroactive to January of the year after you earned that money. There's always a delay. You know, you work through the calendar year, you get through December, etc. They're going to eventually get the records, usually sometime in the first quarter, and there'll be a little time for them to get all the systems updated and everything. And so maybe in March or so, they finally reflect an increase to your benefit, and maybe it goes up by $50 a month or something like that. They're not only just going to automatically give you that adjustment, they're going to make that adjustment effective January of the year. Because it's not your fault that there was some time delay from when you experienced those earnings before they could figure it out and get it applied to your record. So they'll make you whole, and you'll get a lump sum makeup distribution for those months that may have been missed up to the point when they did the adjustment itself. So that's how they do it. They watch it. Now, be aware, as we've discussed on the show before, that any earnings that come after age 60 get treated at face value. There's no further indexing or inflation adjustment to your earnings record after age 60. That's the last year you get that benefit. We've talked about that in a variety of shows in the past, talking about Social Security. But they do include them, which surprises a lot of people. Some people think once they, especially once they start claiming, let's say you've claimed, but you still work, if you're working a lot before your full retirement age, you probably aren't receiving anything because of the earnings test. But just because you're claiming, if you're 66, 67, 68, 69, maybe older, so a lot of people do work into their 70s or all the way to the very end of their lives, they're still working. Those earnings are being tracked and considered in your benefit, and they will automatically adjust for them.
Was that my cue?
That's your cue.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. All righty. I think that was an excellent answer, or good answer. I don't know if I want to give you too much credit.
Well, thanks for everything you give me.
All right, this next one isn't really a question. Guys, technically asking you a question or throwing you under the bus, one or the other.
Uh-oh.
He says, "Hi, Jim, Chris, and the gang. I got a good chuckle when Jim described not liking crunchy peanut butter or nuts in brownies and cookies." Mm-hmm. "And generally, any foreign object at all in food. I totally agree. Well said, Jim." Mm-hmm. "Why, thank you." Then he throws you under the bus.
Uh-oh.
"Chris, you are second to none in Social Security expertise. However, did I miss your promised comeback on an example of the 1960 to 1962 Social Security miss? I was really looking forward to understanding if people would miss out on $5, $500, or $5,000. That's like the fourth or fifth or sixth or 25th person asking for this thing you promised when I was in Ohio. So just figured I would read that.
Yeah, I would. Let me summarize it, and I will give people an example, including dollars. But the way you can think about it is everyone's going to miss inflation adjustments in the year that they were 61. And for those that don't know what I'm talking about, well, I've discussed it on another show. I don't want to go into all the gritty details. But when they're figuring out your Social Security, inflation plays a part. Inflation being applied to your wages when they're assembling your earnings record, and then inflation via cost of living adjustments once you actually reach claiming age, 62 and beyond. But there's like this, I call it the donut hole at age 61, that year, inflation that happens there doesn't apply to your earnings record, doesn't make your earnings record better, higher, which would increase your benefit, and it also doesn't create a cost of living adjustment that gets applied to the benefit itself. Everybody misses it. So there's kind of a baseline. So in best way I've been thinking, I've been mulling this over, how to get the point across to people. Everyone's going to miss that year. It's just how Social Security works. If it's a year where you have fairly typical inflation from in the United States at the time, you're going to be missing the same thing a whole lot of other people miss. So everyone's kind of on equal footing. But when you happen to be 61 in a year with excessively high transient inflation, and this, I'm being liberal with my use of the term transient, you're missing out on a bigger chunk than average. And that's where the issue comes in. So, you know, if regular old inflation in the United States is 3, just throwing it out there on average, if you're missing a year when it's about 3, you're in the same boat as a whole bunch of other people. But in a year where inflation is 8, if you're missing that year, you're missing a much different inflation adjustment to your benefit compared to someone who's missing a year in which it's 3. And that was the point that really started that podcast when Jim was gone, that I, you know, rattled the hornet's nest in talking about this. And that's my point. In a year where you have a spike in inflation, you're missing something of more value than people who turn 61 in other years, because we do have long periods of kind of average inflation in the United States here. We have shorter periods of these transient, and really high inflation like we're seeing usually is very short-lived, at least historically in the United States in modern history. So that was my point. If you're just unlucky enough to miss out on a year when it's 8 or 8.7, 8.9, something like that, that's different than a year when you're missing out on an average amount of inflation. And that was the point. So you can turn it into a dollar amount, because effectively what you're going to do is you're going to permanently miss forever and ever and ever about a 5% higher benefit than if you turn 61 in a different year. So if your benefit's $2,000, 5% of that's $100, and that's what you're missing. $100 a month for the rest of your life, inflation adjusted. That's kind of a rough way of looking at it. And I'll give you some more hard numbers when I get around to building that little spreadsheet that I promised everybody. But that's kind of we're not talking about thousands of dollars a month or probably even multiple hundreds of dollars a month for most people, but it could be, you know, $100, $200 a month in your benefit, depending on, you know, what your earnings record looks like surrounding that, compared to someone who missed a different year. Missed a different year of inflation. That's the point. Everybody misses that year as far as inflation affecting their benefits. So in that way, we're all equal. Everybody misses a year, the year you're 61. The year you turn 62, you get it, but it's delayed. You really don't notice that until the year you die, because then you never get the last year. But the year you absolutely miss is the year you turn 61. And my contention is, you know, if it's a spike year, that's a bummer. Nothing you can do about it. But it'd be better to miss a year when inflation is more average. That's your cue.
Oh, my cue. Okay, perfect. Well, I didn't know. All right. Well,
good. That makes sense to you. I mean,
it's confusing.
Yeah.
For anybody, it does make sense. I think your spreadsheet idea would be good to show more people. I mostly read that, not necessarily expecting you to get as deep as you did, but people are used to you going down rabbit holes. I read it just because I've gotten about 6, 7, 8 people waiting for you to come up with
this.
I
didn't realize it was going to cause so much turmoil.
But, well, you got to remember, listeners are VGs, Vanguard engineers, yeah, VGs. Yeah. And you're not engineers. When you say spreadsheet, you got them all salivating. And they want to hear this, if not see it. So anyway.
Yeah, I apologize. I fully believed I could get to it before I have, which I have still haven't yet, but this kind of November, December turned out to be a little more hectic in my life than I was expecting. So I apologize for over-promising. I tend to try not to do that. I'm more of the under-promise, over-deliver kind of a guy.
Well, so here you over-promised.
I've fallen short, and I fully admit that. But don't give up hope quite yet. I haven't abandoned my intention of doing that.
Over-promised and under-delivered on this one. All right, this question comes in from, I haven't been reading the states, and this one wrote a very long email, but didn't tell me where he's from. Okay, but anyways, he has a question on 403Bs, more of a question on why we said what we said about 403Bs in a past show. He says, good morning, Jim and Chris and the rest of the gang. I'm an avid listener. I've enjoyed your show for the past 2 years. I first got started while exercising, which there's another one, which, as you know, is critical for long-term planning and health cost control. I do enjoy your pithy banter, but would 86, the game show concept. He's the one, I think I talked about him last week or the week before, who wanted to 86 it, and you looked up what 86 meant. And don't tell me it meant, had something to do with, I can't remember.
Restaurants.
That's right. Restaurants. If you ticked off the hostess.
Or if you were out of something, they'd 86 that menu item so everybody knew. Don't sell any more. The chipped beef, we're out.
Gotcha. So anyways, he says, I have a quick question. We are recently retired and have a 403B and a 401K from our previous employer. We will be starting distributions in January. But I'm not sure which account we should use. On past shows, you've alluded to getting rid of the 403B first, but I'm unsure why. Can you elaborate? And then he went on to give us kudos about other things, but I did have to reference one of the things he said. He said, I'm constantly amazed when I listen to other podcasts, and then he gives an example of a few, I won't name them, and they don't mention any of your ideas on it. I just want to point out to this listener.
We're kind of out there.
Exactly. The approach we take, all jokes aside, to retirement planning, what I've termed the secure retirement income process, the concepts of minimum dignity floor and secure income and fund number, which is a central tenant of my belief on retirement, and we're going to get into a lot of in-depth detail on fund number after my hot operation the first week of January. All of that is my creation, and with Chris's help as well, and how we've evaluated it and refined it, and in our opinion, improved it. But you're not going to hear what we talk about, bantered about on other shows or by other advisors, because no one taught this to me. I've shared with you the reasons why I came up with a lot of the beliefs I have. I shared openly on that. I've encouraged you as listeners to talk to advisors that you want to interview or work with. Find out from them why. Not just how are they going to do things, but why. Why are you going to calculate things this way? Why are you going to do this way? Because the why is sometimes as important as the how. And the why I do things the way I do is because I was totally dissatisfied. And maybe disgusted is too hot of a term, but I can't think of a better word right now in my head. Disgusted by the industry's approach and very simplistic, in my opinion, approach to retirement. That retirement is far more dynamic, far more complicated, far more complex than the industry either wants to admit or at least deal with. And they try to keep it dumbed down to too simple an explanation. So that's why you're not hearing about it. Do you have anything you want to add on that, Chris?
No, there's a few places I've noticed that mention pieces that sound like what we do, but it is not. It hasn't become part of the common vernacular in retirement planning, the way we do things. So if you ask people about, hey, what do you think about the minimum dignity floor? Unless they listen to the podcast, they're going to have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. Anyways, let's get back to his question.
Well, you're going to answer this one. I'm going to put it on you, but let me just share one little thing that'll probably set the stage. The alternate name for 403Bs, sometimes they're labeled TDA, and sometimes you'll see that actually on the statement. There's even no reference to 403B, which is the reference to the code section that created these accounts, but TDA, which stands for Tax Deferred Annuity. That should start to get the wheels turning in your mind about where Jim's going to go with this.
Yeah, and what I'm going to say is generalizations. I'm not trying to say every 403B falls into this category, but the vast majority do. And 403Bs are not, they're the Wild West. They're the last remaining frontier, the last remaining Wild West, in my opinion, of retirement savings accounts. They don't get the attention to fees and the attention to detail that a lot of ERISA protected plans get and a lot of IRAs get by Department of Labor rules. 403Bs are not ERISA protected plans. Now that in and of themselves, in and of itself rather, is not reason to avoid a 403B. But 403Bs for the most part have very high fees and lackluster performing investments. They are often sold with commissions to the people selling them, or very high embedded fees called 12B1 fees or management fees built into the investments themselves that pay the people who are offering them. Some school, they're very popular in schools. So some school districts, if you will, can have 3, 4, 5, 6 different 403B providers, and they're all going there trying to win your business. And a lot of the people representing those companies are paid, or a portion of their salary is paid by commission. And there's nothing wrong with that. I used to be, I told you many a times, an earlier iteration of Jim the Financial Planner was a registered representative of a broker-dealer. I personally didn't like it. I didn't like being compensated by quote-unquote selling something. But a lot of 403Bs do work that way and are structured that way. They're also offered by a lot of insurance companies, and I have nothing against insurance companies. We believe in insurance. We believe, whether it's in annuities or life insurance, that there could be a place for them, for some people in a sound retirement plan. But insurance companies are not known for having very low competitive fees. They have a lot of high fees, and that's really my biggest issue with 403Bs. I find them to have very high fees and investments, Chris, that really don't make me go, wow, this is really good. Few 403Bs, I think, have anything so wonderful in them as an investment choice that you couldn't replicate elsewhere, maybe even at a lower price. So a lot of the issue with 403Bs are how they're offered, how they're sold. Google it if you don't believe me. There's many stories out there where people are trying to bring this to the attention, especially of the regulators. And the insurance company has regulators and Congress in their hands at times, not all the time. But advisors who are listening to this, under the Obama administration, I'm not throwing Obama under the bus or anything. People stop freaking out when I mention politics, but I'm just trying to give you a reference in time. Going way back under the Obama administration, the Department of Labor under the Obama administration, if you remember, Chris, really was trying to come down hard on the movement of money from retirement accounts to IRAs and from IRA to IRA. And they, what did they even call it back then? I can't remember. Was it the fiduciary rule they were going to call it or something like that?
Something like that.
God, yeah. I can't even remember now. I apologize. Yeah. But that fell through. The courts actually ruled that the Department of Labor does not have the ability to regulate IRAs under ERISA. And they were claiming, the Department of Labor was saying under ERISA, we can regulate IRAs. But they, under the proposal, excluded 403Bs. The whole brouhaha that was coming up on moving money from a 401k to an IRA or from an IRA to an IRA excluded 403Bs. And I mention that only because 403Bs are kind of in their own little world, and a lot of them are backed and offered by insurance companies because, as Chris rightfully pointed out, they are a tax-deferred annuity. And even though there are newer annuities that are not sold or distributed to people on a platform that pays a commission. They're called fee-based annuities, where they're usually distributed through a registered investment advisory channel, and the registered investment advisor will put a management fee of their own on top of the annuity. Even though those are out and are new, they haven't migrated over to the 403b world. And they are an annuity. They're a tax-deferred annuity, offered and sold by insurance companies that compensate the people offering them through a commission. And all of that is baked into a lot of the cost of the 403B. Now, I have heard, much like I heard that the Yeti exists, but I've never seen it, I have heard that some 403Bs actually have very, very low-cost options also offered in them.
Well, and Vanguard offers a 403B. Yeah,
and I'm not disputing that those don't exist.
But they are the exception still.
They're not overly common.
Right.
So back to his question. Just because we've warned our listeners on 403Bs doesn't mean, listener, you should debit one account first and the second one second. You should look at them independently. Your 401k might have just as high fees as the 403B or lower. Excuse me, the 403B could have lower fees than the 401k. You should look at your investment choices. You should look at the services offered. You should also find out from both plan providers, do they charge for withdrawals? Some do. Chris and I have seen it. It's appalling, but we have seen it. Some charge for withdrawals. Some limit your withdrawals. A lot don't, but some do. Some say you can take money out once a month, once a quarter. We've seen one once a year. And another one that charged, remember, Chris, it was $40 per withdrawal, right, even if it was the RMD?
Yeah.
That was a company that was trying to get their people to get the hell out when they retired. So you should look at each plan independently. We just shared what we shared about 403Bs to kind of put a red flag up there. We do in the office. When we see people with the 403Bs, it just throws a red flag up. We want to look at this account. We're not willy-nilly, oh, you got to move that to an IRA. No, we should look at it, though. Look at the investments. What are they charging? And it's so hard sometimes to figure out what you're truly paying in these accounts. So that's why we threw up the red flag. And I just would encourage you, if you're going to start debiting money, look at more than just the fee, I freely admit. Look at these other items that I've listed and look at the actual investments themselves. And then also going forward, you may want to look at simplification. If you keep two separate accounts, a 403B and a 401K, they cannot be aggregated for required minimum distribution purposes. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have two different beneficiary designation forms. And it just could get more difficult to manage two separate accounts. The government, Congress, has made it much easier over the past 20 years to consolidate all these different types of retirement accounts into one IRA. And I'm not saying this to encourage you to work with us. We never push that. But to move money to any investment advisor. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, Vanguardian, might be easier to have one Vanguard IRA and handling just one beneficiary form, one required minimum distribution in the future. So multiple accounts can be complex, especially as you age. So these are the things, if I were you, that I would look at and take into account. And maybe it's the 401k that fails your litmus test, and the 403b could be perfect, mm-hmm, or the other way around.
Yep.
Okay. So that's kind of what I was saying on that one.
Perfect.
All righty. This one, I hope I can follow it. I think I know what he was talking about, but it got into the... Remember the topic that we began with saying, don't try this at home?
Yeah, the... f- fake recharacterization. Fake. You know, buying yourself some time on a Roth conversion using a 60-day rollover technique. That's the one we keep warning people to be careful with.
Do not try this at home. So we have a guy who kind of has a question on that. And if y'all don't know what we're talking about, go back and listen to it. I think it's a really cool strategy for maximizing tax brackets the way we used to be able to do before they abolished the ability to recharacterize Roth conversions. But it's not nearly as simple and straightforward. You just got to, again, make your spreadsheet. Oh, not spreadsheet, your checklist. All you do is self VGs. And just make sure you follow a very disciplined checklist. But let me lay out this gentleman's situation. It is a long email, so I'm going to try to just pick up the important points. And I can't quite follow everything, but I think I do. He says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. First of all, thank you very much for an informative show. And Jim, good luck on your procedure." He's thanking me, listeners, or wishing me good luck, for those who don't know, on my, lucky me, on January 4th, I get to have a heart procedure. That's all I'll say with that. Again, the anticipation, Chris, is, I think, going to be worse than the actual day. But I'm just freaking out. I won't lie to you guys. I'm freaking out over it. I think you saw me today, Chris. I'm pretty much freaking out. I think you'll admit that. All right. He gets into a little bit about his health care, and I don't want to share that on the show. But let me just say, listener, I too wish you the best of luck. Okay, so he says, let me get to the point. I have a question regarding 60-day rollover strategy. So you might want to write this down, Chris, so we can follow it for him. Okay. He says, on December 1st of this year, I did a direct transfer. And he names the company, I never heard of it, it's called Alto, from my Alto IRA, but we'll just call it from IRA-A. He said, I did a direct transfer from IRA-A of all cash to my existing Roth at Fidelity.
Okay.
That's a conversion, folks. Mm-hmm.
Which is also a rollover.
It's rollover. He calls it a transfer. Mm-hmm. He moved from an IRA-A, as we're calling it, all cash. He moved to a Roth at Fidelity.
Yep.
He never said that IRA-A was an existing Roth. He called it an IRA, and he called the Fidelity a Roth. So as long as he has the accounts identified correctly, what he did was a conversion.
Right.
Okay. This was all wrapped up by December 8th of this year.
Mm-hmm.
It was $22,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But then on December 9th, I went to Fidelity and asked for a transfer form because I have $8,000 in another IRA at my credit union. We'll call that IRA B. And then he gets into a little bit of his background. I want to skip that. The credit union would not accept the paperwork from Fidelity. Let me pause there. That doesn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. Getting money from banks and credit unions can sometimes be very difficult, especially credit unions for some reason. Not all the time. Some are wonderful to work with. But what I wanted to pause on that are for a simple reason. IRAs pull assets. Mm-hmm. 401ks push assets. So when he moved the money from an IRA to an IRA, IRAs are pulled. So Fidelity would have pulled that money from his Alto, or what we're calling IRA-A. And conversely, I was under the impression Fidelity was trying to pull money from his credit union IRA. But he went to the credit union, I think, with the paperwork in his hand. And that's how I interpreted. Did you? Because he said he actually went to his credit union.
Yeah, that sounds right, because that's the only reason he'd be taking paperwork from Fidelity to his credit union is for him to suck it, pull it over from the credit union, and they said, no, no, thank you.
Right. And that doesn't surprise me. So I'm not looking to throw the banks or credit unions under the bus here. If someone walked into a credit union with Fidelity paperwork and said, here, they're not going to accept it. First of all, the person at the credit union, it's not their job to accept that, especially if it's just the teller or even the person who sits behind that glass and at a desk and you go talk to them. There's going to be a whole department at the credit union that does that. And Fidelity would have sent the paperwork. Fidelity would have pulled it. So I'm kind of surprised, if I understand him correctly or not, that he went into the credit union with his paperwork. So, listener, it doesn't surprise me that the credit union said no, at least the way you're describing it. So I digress. Let me continue. He said, so I simply decided to withdraw the money there, and then I immediately got in my car and drove to Fidelity and deposited the whole check as a direct rollover. Let me pause there. Think he means indirect rollover, yeah. Unless he had the check actually made out to Fidelity, which he might have been able to do at the credit union.
Right.
So let me kind of add a little clarity there to all you listeners who like to geek out on things like I do. You can have a direct rollover and you can have an indirect rollover. A direct rollover is when the check and rollover is only coming. This is, we're going IRA to IRA in this particular case. The check is written out to the IRA custodian, like he's describing here, Fidelity. That's called a direct rollover. It's going directly from the credit union IRA to the Fidelity IRA, even though he touched the check. Mm-hmm. Touching the check isn't what decides if it's a direct or indirect rollover.
Right.
It is how the check is made out. So he doesn't have, if it truly is the way he described, he went with Fidelity paperwork to the credit union. They said, we're not going to honor that, which doesn't surprise me. So he sits there and he says, well, I want to move this to Fidelity, so give me my money. It's $8,000 in this IRA. Give me my $8,000. He can easily do that. That doesn't surprise me. If they wrote the check to Fidelity and handed it to him, that
still direct
is direct and is not subject to a 60-day provision. He could let that check sit for 60 months and then go deposit. Of course, it may not cash in 5 years.
But stale check.
But there's no limit, no time limit on a direct rollover. An indirect rollover is when the check is written to you.
Or now, cash. He could have taken cash from the
Correct.
Credit union.
He could have asked for $8,000 cash, walked outside, probably been robbed, but he could have walked outside with $8,000 in cash if he wanted to. Or have the check written to him, Chris Stein. And then Chris walks out of the credit union. That's a indirect rollover. Chris has just 60 days from that day, because it's when you get constructive receipt. They hand you a check. That's pretty damn constructive receipt. Chris would have had 60 days to get that money to his Fidelity account. So he continues. Am I going to be allowed to do the original Alto IRA, what we call IRA-A, to Fidelity? He says, as I researched it, it is the custodian is not going to inform the IRS if it's an IRA to IRA transfer. He's really confusing me here, and I think he's confused. So again, let's pause and just think this through, listener and listeners. He's fixated on this Alto IRA, IRA-A, which moved directly. He never got a check for that. That money moved directly from IRA-A to Fidelity as a conversion for $22,000. He initiated the paperwork December 1st. It was finished December 8th. That has no impact on the ability to do a 60-day rollover.
Correct.
None. When you go IRA to IRA, called a direct transfer, he never got the check, just a direct transfer, no problem. When you do it via check, as he did on his second one at the credit union, he's describing a situation where he, yes, had the check and touched it, but he also says, Chris, he went to Fidelity immediately in his car and deposited it. Mm-hmm. If the check was written out to him, I don't think Fidelity would have let him endorse the check over, but they might have. So if the check was written to Fidelity and he walked in, still no problem. It is not a violation of the once per year 60-day rollover, because that's not a 60-day indirect rollover because the check was written to Fidelity. But listen, you don't specify who the check was written out to. If it was written out to you,
it's still not a violation because he hasn't done one yet, unless he's done one that he hasn't mentioned
that he hasn't
to
told
us
about.
Because a conversion never, you can do as many conversions as you want.
Absolutely. That was how I was going to wrap it up. So, listener, the fact that this check, even if it was written to you, you clearly got it back into an IRA within 60 days. You said you went in your car and you immediately drove to Fidelity and you deposited that $8,000. Even if it was made out to you and Fidelity said, just endorse the back of the check over to us. I doubt they would have said that, but if they did, still, as long as you haven't done a 60-day indirect rollover over the past 365 days, that one would have been fine. And as Chris finally said, your original IRA-A to Fidelity, as long as you didn't screw up the title of the accounts and it actually went from an IRA to a Roth, you could do as many of those in a year as you want. Those also do not count against the once per 365-day, 60-day rollover.
Yep.
Okay, so anyways, hopefully that answered his question. I think it did.
I think so.
Is there anything else you want to add to
No, I think that? It's fine. That, I mean, there's a lot of variations that could be in the details that he didn't share with us, but as long as that first one was a conversion, that's kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card. You don't have to worry about the 365-day rule related to that one. And then the second one, you know, as long as he doesn't have a prior. It doesn't matter. And if it was a direct, if they made the check out directly to Fidelity, you're exactly right. That is a direct rollover, which there isn't a 60-day issue there as well. But even if he took the cash or had the check made out to him, which he then had the money in his possession, and then he went and made a deposit into Fidelity, because the first one never, you know, didn't check off the 60-day rollover for the year in the first place, he's still fine unless there's another one out there he hasn't mentioned to us. So I think he's totally fine if that's what his worry was, if he's worried he did something wrong or was going to have to undo something. Or from what he's told us, there could be some details out there that undermine that, but I think he's good to go.
Okay. This is another one. I think we already answered this question, and I usually mock them if I
answer. This exact one or just one like it?
No, one. It's same topic. These are all coming in around the same time in December. If we answer this one, just tell me, we'll skip over it. Regarding the 60-day rollover for Roth conversion strategy, I'm already retired and have no earned income. Can I still use this strategy? I think we answered that, didn't we?
I don't recall.
No. All right. Well, perhaps we didn't, so we'll answer it now.
Perfect.
So it begins. Regarding this 60-day rollover conversion strategy, I am already retired and have no earned income. Can I still use this strategy to return the excess amount to my traditional IRA? And the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
There is no work requirement. There is no requirement to have earned income.
I think he's getting concerned because he talks about, you know, this part of this is putting money back in. So, but it's not a contribution. It's a rollover. So there's no earnings required. You don't have to create earnings or recognize earnings, have earnings would be the better way of saying it, in order to allow a contribution, because you're not making a contribution. You're returning money into the IRA structure that you had formally taken out within the allowable period of time. So has nothing to do with earnings at all.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. Some of these questions are just really long, so I don't want to...
We're not promising to answer every question we got in December. Just all the ones from today are going to be from December. So if you sent your question in and it was one of the really long ones, that's it does reduce your odds of getting addressed on the show because it's just not practical to do the super long ones.
Okay. So this one came from someone in the good state of, it's named after a president.
It's named at Washington.
Was he a president?
Yeah.
Okay. You are correct. I don't think there's any other state named after a president.
Well, I thought it was a trick question, so I was really churning through my mind, thinking.
Trying to get through all 50?
Yeah. Okay. We'll go.
I would assume Washington State was named after George Washington. I don't know.
So you don't even know? And you're just assuming? I think it was too, but you said it like you knew.
No.
Oh, okay. We'll go with that. If someone from Washington State knows differently, let us know.
Exactly. All right. Hi, Jim and Chris. I'm 61, married, and live in Washington. Mm-hmm. I have $2 million in a 401k, and I have started converting it to a Roth. I'm planning to retire at 65, and I'm thinking about buying a QLAC at that age and have it begin making payments at 85. So far, pretty straightforward, folks. Gentlemen, early 60s, trying to convert his $2 million 401k into Roths over the next few years.
Well, at least part of it.
It's part of it, yes. Yeah. And then when he turns 65, he wants to purchase a QLAC, Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract, QLAC. And it's just a type of deferred annuity that can be held inside a 401k if they offer them, few do, or an IRA. The government limits how much money you can put in, but under the new Secure Act 2, we received several emails from people, Chris, asking us to please talk about Secure 2 now that it's passed. Let me say, are you crazy? Not right now. Have you seen the length of this damn thing?
I know.
It's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. I'm not going to start answering or even explaining anything that I even read yet until this is well digested and I get very, very good summaries from these places that actually pay to give me these summaries. Let them have the pleasure of reading this monstrosity and figure out what's truly in there. But I do know one of the things in there is they're going to increase the amount people will be able to put into QLACs amongst many other things that are built into this. So we've already received several emails, people asking us to opine. We're not. Chris and I got burned on Secure One when we jumped down that rabbit hole way too soon. And then many of the things we thought were in there never turned out to be in there. And then the IRS just screwed everyone over 2 years later when they came out with their own interpretation of Secure One. And let's be slow, folks. Let's just methodically wait for the people who have nothing better to do over the holidays to digest what's in this. The politicians who passed it didn't even read it. So these reports you're reading are just all little snippets being announced. Oh, it's in this and this and this. Nobody knows. Nobody's read the damn thing yet. So we won't talk about it for a while until I can get some clearer understanding. Anyways, coming back to this, everything he said so far, folks, makes perfect sense. We've seen this before. He feels he needs additional secure income. He's going to use a QLAC, Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract, because it will allow him to take some of his IRA or 401k money, put it in this deferred income style annuity, and that annuity, even though it's still going to be in an IRA wrapper or 401k wrapper, he doesn't tell us which account he's going to open it in. Even though they're still in those wrappers, they will have no required minimum distributions during the deferral phase. That's why the government, the Department of Treasury, actually created QLACs on their own after the 2008 debacle. They wanted the ability for retirees to establish an additional pool of secure income without being burdened by required minimum distributions. It's the only annuity that the government pretty much designed from the bottom up, but private insurance companies offer. The government doesn't offer QLEX. Private insurance companies do. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a little breakdown, folks, of what he's doing. I like it. I'm going to assume he made some calculations. He knows he needs additional secure income. He's taking a very pragmatic and simple approach. Hey, I'm going to put some of my $2 million into not much. I'm sure he's only putting $100,000 or so. I'm going to guess because the current limit is like $125,000 or $130,000. So it's not a big amount of money he's probably putting in, but it's going to give the old to him money. Okay, he says, but on a recent show, I heard Jim mention that he too has a deferred income annuity in his Roth IRA. You are correct, listener. I've talked openly about this. I have a Roth IRA. It does not have a QLAC. In fact, QLACs are not available in Roth IRAs because QLACs have no required... Right. Excuse me.
So there's no need to have them either.
Yeah. Roth IRAs have no required minimum distribution requirements. So you can put a more traditional style annuity, if you'd like, inside a Roth IRA. And that's what I did. It is a deferred income annuity. It will not pay me until the future. I've been crunching the numbers recently, Chris, because of my stroke, to see if I want to turn it on next year at age 60 or continue to wait till 70. And I'm torn. I'll freely admit that, and I'll let my listeners know what I decide to do, but right now I don't know. I can torn either way. But I have a more traditional deferred income annuity in my Roth. So he continues, it has me now wondering, would this be a viable alternative to my QLAC strategy? Would payments from a single premium deferred annuity I purchase in my Roth IRA be tax-free? If the answer is it depends, is there a way I can structure it so they will be tax-free? The easy answer is yes, they will be tax-free. Of course, your IRA, your Roth IRA would have to be 5 years old for the growth to come out tax-free. I'm just going to assume your Roth is five because you already said you're 61. You have $100,000 in a Roth already and you're going to be converting more in.
Well, it certainly would be by the time in 85 when it turns on.
Correct. So you could defer the money in the Roth and begin taking tax-free money at 85. But I would be hesitant on that. If you're going to defer money inside a Roth for very, well, hesitant on the type of annuity that I have. I have a deferred income annuity inside my Roth. Now, my deferred income annuity does give me the ability to call the deal off and take my account balance. But my account balance is very small in comparison to what they're promising me as income. This deferred income annuity that I have is no longer available, so don't anyone write and ask what it is. You can't get it. But every year that I delay my income, it goes up by 7%. And I can call the deal off and get my account balance out at any time, which is growing at a much, much smaller and lower level than the 7% that my income is growing at. And one of the things that I'm torn on, Chris, is how long am I going to live? Mm-hmm. I had a very serious medical condition. You guys know this. If I wait a very long time and turn it on, I might not get all of my money out of that Roth. Now, it's not lost because I can name a beneficiary who would inherit the lump sum of money. He's talking about a different strategy, I think, listeners. And I kind of like his strategy. The annuity that I have in mind is no longer available, so I'm attracted to his strategy. Tell me if you think I'm on track of what he's thinking, Chris. Mm-hmm. Rather than put his money in a QLAC in a traditional IRA, which is an irrevocable decision, folks. You buy a QLAC, you cannot undo it. You have agreed for the rest of your life to take an income stream, no longer a lump sum. I'm under the impression that he is considering taking the money that he would have put in the QLAC inside his IRA and maybe putting it inside his Roth IRA instead. Maybe then invest that money and let it grow, hopefully, over the next 20 years until he's 85. And then let the older him, which is what Chris and I always prefer doing, just reserve the money. Let the older you decide if he or she wants the income at that point. Then at 75, 80, 85, whatever the age, the older them can say, wow, I put this money when I was 65 in my Roth, and now it's worth $600,000. I'm making these numbers up, folks. It's worth $600,000, and I do want a lifetime stream of income. I want to go out and buy it. They can take all or a portion of that $600,000 and buy an income stream. Mm-hmm. And yes, that income stream will be 100% tax-free. That's what I think he's contemplating, and I like the idea of it. But it does expose him to some risk. The risk would be that the $135,000, in my example, I don't know why I'm fixated on that's what he's putting into his QLAC, the $135,000 that he puts instead into a Roth does not have the guarantee that the QLAC would come with. And maybe it doesn't grow to a size big enough to generate the income that the QLAC would have. That's always a risk. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a very strong risk because I do think that money will grow, but there's no guarantee. And then maybe when he buys the SPIA in the future, he would have had or get less than if he would have had the QLAC. But Chris, you and I favor the flexibility of his second strategy, I think, over the first. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's you just never know what's going to happen over that 20 years. And I'm always hesitant to commit that young to an irrevocable decision, which is what takes the shine a bit in my mind off of the traditional QLAC approach. But there's lots of other trade-offs out there. We don't know anything about what other uses the Roth might have that might make that strategy extra attractive. Like if there's a inheritance goals, or at least the likelihood an inheritance would take place, and they would prefer to have, or their situation would be benefited by the Roth being in the inheritance or not. That's nice to take that Roth approach, because then if you end up not using it, you can have it kind of positioned or invested in a way for future growth, knowing that you might tap it in the future for income. But if you don't, it's in the nice, lovely Roth wrapper, so that your beneficiaries don't have to worry about immediate tax consequences when they inherit it. That's, I think, if that's an issue or potential in your situation, that's worth considering. That gives kind of extra, another check mark in the pros column for using the Roth as the reserve for that future income generation if needed. You're right. You're not going to get the guaranteed performance that is going to be baked into the QLAC taking that approach. But, there's not one. If retirement planning would be easy, investment would be easy if there was always just one choice and it was the best for everyone. You'd have, very simplistic approaches and everybody would do them. So I would just make sure you're weighing all of the options and maybe make a list of pros and cons and see, and different people, even if they have the same list of pros and cons, some might opt for one versus the other because they, are more or less valuing of certain pros or more or less scared of certain cons in the list. And I think, always using the mantra with some of these decisions that I stole from a client of ours, honestly, the minimizing your maximum regret can help clarify things a lot. Look at, what situation would I regret the most if it were to occur? And let that be, kind of a guiding light on what you want to avoid doing. Knowing that there could, as long as you're avoiding the the worst thing that you would, you know, the thing that you would really regret the most, that can be success. Even if you don't end up getting the best possible positive outcome, at least you are in a position of being comfortable knowing you won't experience your greatest regret. That can be a way to help, you know, weigh the scale one way or the other on these kind of comparisons.
Yeah. So think it through, but short answer is yes, money in an annuity pay out of a Roth will maintain the tax-free benefits, if you will, of the Roth. It's right. One of the reasons I'm thinking of turning mine on at age 60. It's tax-free. It's not going to raise my income any. It's not going to subject me to higher income taxes. Nothing like that. Yeah, it's
no
just
IRMA considerations, no Social Security taxability considerations.
My whole reason for wanting to turn it on early is purely financial, selfish financial. I hope I live a very long time, but what happened to me just makes you think in the back of your mind, and you do wonder, I wonder if I should turn this on earlier now in light of everything that's happened. And in all honesty, folks, my particular Roth is so small relative to how I'm going to fund my retirement. I just don't think it would matter if I waited or not.
A low stakes decision.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very low stakes decision. For others listening, it's going to be a very important decision.
Yep.
And the only other thing I want to throw out there before we wrap up, because I know it's getting long. Mm-hmm. If that gentleman wants to try to reduce required minimum distributions beyond his conversions, he only said he's going to convert for a few more years. I'm guessing he's going to go from 61 to maybe 63 and then worry about IRMA. I don't know. But he said he's only going to convert for a few more years. If he doesn't get enough converted and he's worried about RMDs, the QLAC would help there. And we have used QLACs to help people reduce required minimum distributions because the money in the QLAC, which does not have to come out until age 85, that's the latest you can defer them, the money in the QLAC is not subject to required minimum distribution rules during the deferral period. So there could be a benefit that he wouldn't get in the Roth strategy because his IRA would still stay fairly big. It wouldn't be able to be reduced by the QLAC purchase. Yeah. So there's a couple of moving pieces there for him to consider. But I like lifetime stream of guaranteed income, and I especially like a tax-free lifetime stream of guaranteed income.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that'll bring us to the end of the final EDU show of 2022. So we thank everybody for listening. Thank everybody for sending in questions.
No. We're recording another one. It comes out on Saturday.
This is the final EDU show for 2022.
Oh.
We will do a Q&A show.
Never mind.
Mm-hmm. So close. I know it feels like a Q&A show, but we're still technically
an EDU
series.
This is our fun month of December. Right. Woohoo!
Right.
Woohoo! Yeah. And then we'll get into it in January. And if everything goes well in January, we will be doing a series of shows on the concept behind fun number.
Yeah, sounds good. So if you want to send in your own questions for a future show, jim@jimhelps.com is probably the best way to do it. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Make sure in the subject line you indicate it's a question for the podcast. He'll put it into the pile. Hopefully you get chosen for coverage on the show here.
And don't give up. It could be a year and a half, 2 years later. But
true. He might find you as he's rummaging through all of his old receipts from the grocery store and stuff, and then he finds it, and we say, hey, this is even still a pertinent question today, 3, 5, 12 years later.
I don't think we've ever gone that far. 2 years. I think 2 years is the longest.
Probably true.
But anyways.
Okay. Sounds good. We'll be back with you in a couple of more days with our final show of 2022. Take care, everybody.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim, H-E-L-P-S.com, or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.